Welcome, everyone. This is FANI, the podcast that celebrates African scientists. And I'm your host, Alex Nyako. I'm a senior research specialist at David Denison. And I'm hosting today's session with
Selassie Afrekwache, and I'm a postdoc at the University of Maine.
So today we are very excited to have with us Dr. Kwame Owusu-Deko. Kwame is an associate professor at the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences in the University of West Florida. So Kwame, thank you so much for joining us. We are very excited to have you here on SANI.
Thank you both for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
All right, so we'll get straight into it, Kwame. So we usually like to start by trying to get a sense of the background of our interviewees to really understand how they went into their career path. So how did your past experiences, how did your past upbringing, how did your schooling influence and shape your career path in the current field that you pursue?
Okay, yeah. So usually when I get asked questions like this, I don't start from as far back as I'm going to start from, but because you use the word upbringing, so I you know, born, I raised, went to school, up until, you know, up until college, you know, in Ghana. And I lived in Kumasi. My parents, you know, are university professors. They're both retired, but still, you know, teach on contract. And so I guess, you know, that is, you know, somewhat privileged background in Ghana, you know, not, you know, swimming in money or anything like that, but, you know, exposed to a lot of people and circumstances and things like that. And so I think I just realized or was aware of that privilege, you know, and I went to a very, I'm very surprised I'm using the word diverse to describe Ghana, but economically diverse school. Where, you know, because, you know, you had like the literate kids, you had people in the city who were like, you know, the movers and shakers, and you had people, you know, who, you know, parents were struggling to make ends meet. And so I think that experience really, one, it made me recognize sort of the economic privilege I had, but it always made me also curious about, I guess, issues of poverty, you know. And so at the time I didn't notice that, but that interest was what drove a lot of my other interests, you know. And so for as far back as I can remember, as a child, I wanted to be a lawyer. I do not know why. I just wanted to be a lawyer. Like, nothing else made sense. Nothing else excited me. You know, I think about doctor, engineer. You know, in Ghana, we, you know, pushed very early into a field, you know, whether sciences or, you know, humanities or social sciences. And so, because I wanted to be a lawyer, you know, I said I was going to do arts. And my parents were not very excited at the thought, you know, because they're like, well, you're smart, you know, you should do science. But I insisted. And so the compromise was that I do arts with elective maths, you know. And so, and I hated maths. I still hate maths. Like, I'm very, very bad at it. I just don't have to do it as much or even at all, you know, I'll say as much now. And so I, yeah, I went to a secondary school. That's actually, you know, how I met Alex in Prosec. And even there, I wasn't realizing the connections at the time, but the subject that really interested me was geography, you know, and I did very well at geography without even trying. You know, I was always curious about what was going on in other parts of the world and things like that. And so I get to tech, and by that time, I'm very determined. I'm like, I'm going to become a lawyer. Like, yes, this was the agreement. I fulfilled my part. I did the emails for you. I'm going to become a lawyer. And then they come in with another curveball. They're like, oh, you know, it's not good to be a narrowly trained lawyer because, because I grew up in Kumasi and I grew up in university campus, I wanted to go to tech. That was also another thing. I was like, I'm going to the University of Science and Technology. I'm not going anywhere else. It was sort of my university, you know, goal. But then because I was toying with the idea of being a lawyer, I was slowly becoming open to, you know, going to school in Accra, University of Ghana. But then at that time, right about when I was about to enter, Tech started a first year or first degree law program in LLP.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
And so then I was like, yes, everything is perfect. And then my friends were like, no, we need you to slow down on the law, because all the lawyer friends we've talked to see that it's not good to be a narrowly trained lawyer. You don't want to do an LLB in law and then go and do your the graduate degree and all of that's law. Like, you need some of the background to be more well-rounded. And they went so far as talking to a former Supreme Court justice, whom they knew from some other circles. And then he was like, yeah, that's very good advice. You shouldn't be an Irish trained lawyer. So I was like, fine, I'll do something else. And again, my father had been pushing for land economy as the first degree. But again, because of my struggle with mathematics, and because of that, I also struggled a bit with economics. So I heard the word economy, I was like, nope. I'm not in life economy. I'm going to do development planning, and I didn't even really know what development planning was about. But that was a compromise that came to, like, okay, fine. If we won't let you do law, but then do development planning. And so development planning is basically about just organizing space and settlements and infrastructure development, social services, like everything, from the perspective of Ghana, it's basically how would you plan a country at all levels. So you could take it from as very little as a neighborhood all the way to national issues, and so we learn all those skills and how to plan for all those skills and sectors. And I actually fell in love with it. I remember having a conversation with a friend in our first semester. I was like, I don't think, and he also wanted to, do planning and then go and do law. And I told him straight up front, I was like, I don't think I'm going to become a lawyer anymore. I'm really enjoying this, because I saw so many, one thing that really excited me about planning was it was really concerned with poverty alleviation and really concerned with helping people who don't have as much as others have, which I think had been sort of my life sort of experience and ethos. And so, I did development planning, and by that time I was hooked. I probably wanted to work for an international NGO or something. But then when I finished tech and then I did national service, I lived in a village, I was teaching. It was basically like a short-term missions program with sort of a student Christian organization. And so I was living in the village, teaching in the schools, helping with capacity building programs and churches and things like that. And then one day a student asked me a question. I think it was English. I was teaching English and PE. And so the student asked me a question. I gave them an answer. They were not very satisfied. You could see that they were still confused. And so they asked me a follow-up question. And I gave them a follow-up answer. And then I saw the light bulb literally go on their face. I want to do this for the rest of my life. I just felt so much satisfaction and accomplishment. I literally saw the student's face like transform.
Yeah, lit up, yeah.
Because they had understanding. I was like,
yeah.
And so, at that point, I really considered becoming a teacher. But I was like, okay, this is Ghana. And I saw how teachers had lived, and how they struggled and things like that. And so I was like, okay. I think, again, growing up as the child of two professors, I was like, okay, I've seen the level of, quality of life my parents have lived. I think if I want to be a teacher, again, compromise is let me become a university professor. I feel like now that I'm recounting this, I feel like my life is full of making compromises. Then that was that ambition. And so I wanted to come to grad school in the U.S., and I ended up at the University of Iowa studying master's in urban and regional planning. And so I think when I got there, I was slightly disappointed, just because I knew it going in, but I didn't realize it would be such a struggle. But this program was heavily U.S. focused, very, very heavily U.S. focused.
Yeah.
And so I always found myself just like struggling to sort of comprehend what even people were talking about, because it's also very place-based and, you know, context-specific. And so I was like trying to, you know, really understand what references they're making and what issues and policies and all the while I'm asking, so how will this play out in Ghana? Like, how could this even work, you know? And so I almost felt like I was gaining knowledge that it was difficult for me to translate or use back home. And so I remember usually in my master's program, between, it was a 2-year program, so usually in the summer between the first year and the second year, you're encouraged to do an internship. And so I was, you know, thinking about what internship could I do. I didn't, you know, want to leave the city, but it was hard to find an internship in the city where I lived, Iowa City. And I saw basically, I call it a flyer, but basically an A4 sheet, you know, where you rip off the number and the email. And they said, do you want to be a solutionary? I was like, solutionary? Like, what is a solutionary? You know, I never even heard the word before. And so, you know, I look up in the organization, and it's actually a youth-led nonprofit, you know, part of a wider organization called Grand Aspirations, and they were called Iowa City Summer of Solutions. And basically, they spent the whole summer just doing local community development projects, you know, on environmental issues, on social issues, on, you know, equity, economic, you know, equality, all of those things. And so that was the first time, like, I started having this connection, you know, where my interest in poverty were then beginning to merge with all the stuff I was learning about regional planning and the environment. And for the first time, like, I saw it all connect together, you know, in the work of that group, you know. And so I was like, okay, I think I haven't made a mistake, you know, I'm on the right track. So I finished the master's, and then obviously the plan now was, you know, school is to become a professor. So I was like, okay, I guess I need a PhD. So I ended up at the University of South Carolina, do my PhD in geography or human geography, you know. So again, connecting back to that love for geography in secondary school. And my advisor at the time, for me, I was just interested in, you know, like I said, poverty alleviation, international development, you know, anything to, you know, sort of bring, you know, economic progress to, you know, some parity. And so my advisor at the time was working, or had just started working, on some climate change projects, you know, and he had done his own research in Ghana, so he was very familiar with the context and the country and all those things. And so he started working on some international climate change adaptation project, you know, how human beings can get ready and respond to, you know, a rapidly changing climate. And so that was how my own interest in climate change sort of came into the picture. And then I ended up doing my dissertation research on sea defense systems in the Volta Delta of Ghana. And how just different stakeholders around these systems are evaluating, you know, the success or failure of these systems. And so, you know, talking to people, the national governments, the people who live in and around the fishing communities near these structures, some consultants who worked on them, some contractors who worked on them, just trying to assess, you know, how each group, you know, evaluated them, and seeing if, you know, these were good investments of, you know, sort of funds, you know, in response to, you know, climate change, you know. So
was your professor a Ghanaian, or just was your professor a Ghanaian or
from? No, he's an American. He's a white American. Yeah, but he's anthropologist / geographer, and so he spent considerable years in Ghana. No, but he wasn't a Ghanaian. But he definitely did connect me to, you know, that climate change space, and even the current, that sort of current project that helped me get back to Ghana, you know, to work on sea defense systems. So I finished that, and then ended up getting a job at the University of West Florida in an environmental science department. You know, it's like, okay, I feel like it's all coming full circle now. And so I guess just having that idea for that love for justice, you know, because even I didn't mention this at the beginning, but even wanting to be a lawyer, I wanted to be a criminal justice lawyer. Like, I want to put the bad guys, you know, behind bars and all of those things. And it just seems to come together, you know, in realizing that the environment is more holistic, you know, than we think, you know. And when we talk about environment, usually we're either referring to what is surrounding us as human beings or sort of the biophysical world around us, you know, but it's all of that, you know, intertwined. And so, yeah, speaking of putting bad guys behind bars, you know, some of my most recent research right now is having to do with environmental justice and thinking about how, especially in the US, certain communities are overburdened with, you know, pollution and things like mm-hmm. that. And so,
yeah,
I guess I'm still trying to put bad guys behind bars with my research.
Yeah. That's inspiring. A lot of the times, I know that when we are young and we see people out there with their lives, it looks like everything was just planned out, like right from the beginning. But again, sometimes after you've gone through it, you look back and it's just amazing how everything is somehow connected in one way or the other. So mm-hmm. it's just an encouragement for our listeners that even if right now you seem confused, sometimes everything does connect together. Yeah. And so, Kwame, at this point, would like us like you to tell us more about your research on this impact of climate change and pollution on marginalized groups, like in layman terms, and what are the main areas and problems that your research is trying to address?
Yeah. So, when we talk about marginalized, you know, groups, you know, if you take any society, those who have the least access to resources, be financial or social or just physical, you know. And so when I'm talking about sort of my upbringing and what interested me the most, you know, was this issue of, you know, sort of the marginalized, you know, poor people and things like that. And so in the US, marginalized groups, you know, income and race, you know, highly correlate, you know, and so a lot of marginalized groups in the US are communities of color. And then when you look at just impacts of pollution, like I said, when I was talking about environmental justice, a lot of landfills mm-hmm. are mm-hmm. sited near predominantly racial minority communities. Anytime somebody wants to bring in industrial sites or even former industrial sites, you know, you look at the demographics surrounding them and you see that. And there's a lot of debate about, you know, which came first. Is it that mm-hmm. you know, the industries targeted, you know, these communities, or after the construction or siting of these industries, because these communities are, you know, historically placed by systemic injustices that they ended up moving there, you know. And so that's what I mean when I talk about marginalized, you know, populations, just people with the least access, even political access. They may be diminished in their even political structures. They don't really have a voice, you know, not a voice, but don't have a seat at the table. Their mm-hmm. concerns might be dismissed, you know. And so I guess in my working now, it really has revolved with, you know, racial minority groups, predominantly Black, you know, communities. And so to just give a current example, I'm working with a community in Gulf County, Florida. It's called North Boston Joe, and there used to be a former paper mill sited next to the community, operated for about 60 years. Mm-hmm. And so everybody worked in the mill, but then it also was operating at a time, you know, when the U.S. was highly segregated. And so mm-hmm. even though everybody worked in the mill, you know, Black people had their entrance, white people had their entrance, you know, things like that. And so and the neighborhood, the Black neighborhood, was literally separated by the railroad track, you know. And so the mill eventually shut down. Everybody lost their jobs, you know, but because there was already this sort of racial inequality and segregation, the impact was worse on the Black community, and they also lived right next to them, you know? So when we are tracing health impacts and contamination of the soil and the water, a lot of it is in and around the Black community. And so a group of them, the Black residents, you know, banded together to try and revitalize, mm-hmm. you know, the community, try to bring, you know, just, you know, the economy back, try to bring jobs back. And they came up with a development plan, all of that, but they were really struggling to find funds, you know, because they needed significant amounts of funding to do that. And so a group of researchers, which I was involved in, came together to provide technical assistance to them, you know, to write and apply for some of these federal grants. And they've won, shoot, almost like, at least for federal funding, almost $900,000, you know, in the space of about 2 years.
Wow.
Because of that, you know, that group.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and I think even in private funds, if you add private funds, they're probably getting close to $1 million. So now the struggle is, because of, again, that historical segregation, they have a very fraught relationship with their city government. And a lot of the visions that they have, they stop short at getting city approval. You know, supposing they want to change the streetscape, or they want to, you know, have different kinds of buildings, or they want to even overhaul the drainage, you know, in the neighborhood, they would need city council approval, you know, and support, you know. And so because of that fraught relationship, you know, they have lost out on a lot of projects that way. And so our most recent effort is really trying to repair that relationship, get them in conversation with the city government, get them all together in a room and really reflect on, like, okay, what are the issues at hand and how can we actually move forward together as one, like, united community, you know. And so I think that's really what my research revolves around, just connecting, you know, communities that have not had access, historically have access to resources, connecting them to those resources, providing support, building capacity, facilitating conversations, bringing in other experts, you know, because my research is mainly like qualitative. And so, I'm not an expert in like soil sampling and air quality sampling, all those things, sampling, but other people are. And so finding, you know, those people and connecting, coming together as a team, you know, a collaborative team. And so I highly, you know, believe in team and interdisciplinary science, you know, like I just know that we can't solve any of our problems, you know,
we try to do it in silos or try to do it alone.
And so, and because this is, I guess I didn't mention that this is a coastal community. So because it's a coastal community, they've had to deal with hurricanes and other things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's where the climate change bit comes in. And so thinking about knowing that our climate is changing, knowing that our seasons will not be the same, how can we be prepared for an incredibly hot summer like we're experiencing now? How can we be prepared for a very intense hurricane season that Florida probably might get another one, you know, this fall? And so and how can we make sure that even in rebuilding or bringing this community back, the things that we're building are resilient to, you know, extreme weather events, are cool enough in extreme heat, you know, things like that. So that we don't just think about only the present, but we're thinking about the future while, you know, as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Kwame. I think one key point that you mentioned really sticks to me is the critical need for interdisciplinary science, especially in our time where we really need to bond our efforts together, looking at one primary objective and how we can each bring our expertise into solving a problem that would eventually lead to the onward movement of our various communities.
Mm-hmm.
So Kwame, wanted to ask Ness, what does a usual day as an active researcher look like? Primarily for up-and-coming scientists in Africa who are looking to also get into a role similar to yours. What does an active researcher day look like?
Yeah. So before COVID, it looked like, you know, always going to, you know, the office and sitting at a desk and, you know, spending copious amounts of time on the computer. It's the same without always going to the office. So typically now, I will only go to the office when maybe I have classes to teach as well. A lot of my work I do from home. Again, because I'm not like a laboratory scientist or like a bench scientist, you know, with labs and, you know, all of these things to do, I can do a lot of my work remotely. But it's just reading a lot, you know, just finding out what the literature is saying, finding what other people are saying about the topic, looking for answers to questions. And I didn't realize this, but now a lot of my work is involves a lot of emailing people, and especially if you do research that you know, revolves around connecting people, you know, and working with people. Like, I send a lot of, I was like, I didn't realize I would send a lot of emails, but I'm always sending and drafting emails to somebody and asking something and trying to have a conversation and setting up a meeting, you know, with people to talk about, you know, issues or to plan a certain project or things like that. I mentioned because of this interdisciplinary or team approach, you know, to science or solving problems, you know, I have to spend a fair amount of time in meetings and then reviewing documents. And we try to cut that down sometimes, you know, because sometimes just meeting is not always the most effective use of our time. And so if we can review something over email, we'll do that and send documents back and forth. If that saves us a meeting, we'll do that. But digging, you know, I think over the course of my, especially, over my PhD years, I really developed a knack for finding information. Like, I know, even when I'm doing like Google Scholar searches, like I know how to word things to find different kinds of things. Like, if I'm looking for a specific article, I'm not finding it. I don't know. I seem to have developed this skill of, okay, I know if I change it, or I even change the order of the words, you know, I'll find what I want, you know. So it involves just a lot of data mining, you know, and I'm not using data mining in a very technical sense, you know, but digging for information, you know, and really, really trying to search. Is what typically my research day, you know, looks like.
And so just a follow-up question, in terms of like your meetings, how our listeners to get a clear picture, how do some of those meetings look like for a researcher that's working on climate change and pollution?
It depends. Some of those meetings are, you know, very, very small, and I think I prefer smaller meetings, you know, with 3-4, maybe maximum 5 people, because I think usually when a meeting gets too big, especially a Zoom meeting, you know, people just tend to be in the background, don't turn on the cameras, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, but typically, typically always have an agenda, and somebody should have done something by the time that we meet. And so we'll follow up on, you know, did you look up this data? Did you ask this person what you're supposed to ask them or follow up on that, you know? Okay. Have we recently done a field test? Yes, exactly. Have we done any kind of field test recently? What were the results? You know, we said we're waiting for some soil samples to come back. You know, have you heard anything back, you know, from the lab about that and things like that? And so, a lot of it is strategizing, planning, and then getting updates from people. As well, there's been a few meetings where we've actively sat in and written something, like a communication piece or something like that. I'm not a big fan of those, but the most recent one I did, it was very productive, and I think it was better that we actually sat down, because we spent like I think 3.5, almost 4 hours total working on that, and had been in meetings the whole day, so I was not very excited by the time I went to sit in that meeting, but the goal was accomplished. So sometimes where you need to get something done, and you're like, okay, let's just sit
together. Let's just all sit in and get it done. Yeah. Wow, I'm pretty sure that's kind of different from maybe what some of our listeners are used to when they hear about researchers. And so, what are some of your memorable highlights and lowlights in your research? What have been some really fun moments, and then some like down moments?
Yeah, I think I'll be in the down moments first. I'll get those out of the way. I think for me, one of the biggest down moments was when I got my first journal, not just rejection, because, you know, usually when you submit it to a scientific journal or peer review journal, there's a desk reject from the editor where he's like, no, this is not suitable for it. No, that wasn't too bad. But when I got reviews, and the reviews were like scathing, and they were just like, I was like, oh my gosh. Literally just, you know, rubbished, you know, everything that I wrote, you know. And I, you know, this is, you know, on the high of, you know, because this was something for my PhD, you know, that I had submitted to for publication. And so coming on the highs of, you know, oh my gosh, your PhD is so interesting and exciting, and hearing all these things, and just getting a job, and, you know, feeling like, okay, like I'm doing something right. And then, you know, you send your work into the world, and, you know, it's shredded, you know, and the reviews are horrible. And that even wasn't so bad. It was after I responded and revised, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, you know, the basically the second round was even worse, because so I'm throwing my PhD advisor a bit under the bus here. It's not, but it's not even his fault, but it was just, you know, something I assimilated, you know, by proxy. You know, by the time I worked with him, he was very accomplished. He was associate professor for a while, almost about to become full professor, all of those things. And so he had very little patience for general reviews, and he would always rant and rave and complain, you know, about that, you know, feedback he got and how reviewers don't understand what they're doing, blah 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 blah, you know, and just, you know, make a lot of noise. And that was, you know, verbally. I rarely ever saw the actual reviews he sent in, you know, but the impression he always gave me was that that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to, like, make noise and, like, complain and, like, you know, defend your work, basically, know, and point out to them how little they know about, like, basically re-school them in your responses. You know, so my naive self in my replies was like, okay, I made all these changes, but blah, 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 blah. And then one reviewer came back and said, I remember it so vividly, he was like, and he was complaining to the editors, like, and the author is even so far as going to insult. I did not insult him, but I guess I was not also polite. And he's going back to insult me and said, you won't get fire in science with this kind of attitude. And it was very, very soul crushing, you know, because I was like, I thought that's what I was supposed to do, you know. But that was definitely a wake up, you know, call.
Yeah.
Me. And then, you know, obviously my approach has totally changed. Now, even when I think even the risk, this, like, the what I mean I should do is needless, I'm like, okay, what does it hurt to do it? And I'll calmly say in a very restrained, you know, written tone, I have addressed the reviewer's comments, you know, end of story. But that was a very difficult experience, you know, because again, I thought I was, you know, doing what a scientist is supposed to do, you know, sort of defend your work. And I think a lot of times we don't realize as scientists that no matter the kind of science we're doing, whether it's, you know, physical science or, you know, social sciences or engineering or whatever it is, it's still a very human process, you know, still working with other people. And so there's is a lot of people management, even in peer review and all of these things. And so it's like, I think that was good advice. To get far, you know, you really have to be, you know, sort of savvy with people. So I think that was one of the low points. A second one was just applying for grants and getting rejected, like continuously, like just continuously. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, like, because you spend so much time and energy and effort, you know, to put together a grant application, you know, especially in a team, and you're, you know, wrangling people for things, you know, up until the deadline. And then they're like, sorry, you know. And I think for me, it was just, especially when it was like the same grant where you, like, you reproject or you repurpose to different funders, and still, like, after 2-3, you're still getting rejected, you know. So that was also a real low point, because it almost made me wonder if the project is any good, you know, is the research any good, you know, should I be thinking of something else, you know. So that even up until now, I think it's still a low point, you know. I'm much better if I get a first rejection or second, but when I do like 2-3 times, and then it's still a low point for me. High points, I think, was just finally receiving recognition, you know, for my work. So the first one was when I got an internal university award as an early career researcher, because in my mind, I'm not that good of a researcher, you know. In my mind, I'm a better teacher than I am a researcher. I remember I even had this conversation with my PhD advisor, you know, right when I was taking this job, or about, I don't even know if I'd officially signed the paperwork, maybe I had, but he was trying to convince me to do a postdoc before, you know, instead of taking this job. And I was like, well, because I also had gotten a postdoc you know, at the University of South Florida. And I was like, you know, it's like, this is a tenure track job, you know, significant pay, you know, difference. And I feel like I was told, like, to get a tenure track job is sort of the goal. So if I have it now, you know, what's the point? It's like, well, but, you know, it's a different, you know, sort of tier of university, you know. I don't know if all our listeners are familiar, but, you know, U.S. universities have tiers. So there's Research One, and we call them R2, but regional comprehensive. So I'm at, like, a regional comprehensive university. So we're not, like, a high research, you know, producing, you know, institution. And so I think my advisor was concerned. He thought maybe I was underselling myself, or, you know, getting trapped in, you know, I don't know, place I wouldn't be happy. And so I remember telling him that, no, I'm not confident in my independent research activities. I'm very confident as a teacher, so I'm very happy going to a more teaching heavy school. And so in my mind, I was like, I'm a better teacher than researcher. So the first time I got a research award, I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'm doing something right, you know. And getting two other research fellowships after that, also just, you know, sort of validated, okay, I think people see something in me and in my work and the portfolio that I have that maybe I don't see myself. And so that was a high point. It was just a validation that, I shouldn't think as less of myself as I do when it comes to research, and that, you know, I probably do have stories to tell the world. So
So Kwame, I wanted to do a follow-up on that same question. How did you deal with your low light? What were the tactics you used in dealing when you had to be beat down with all of those things that happened?
So, and this is something I'd heard from a lot of other, you know, academics and researchers, was, you know, to leave it alone, like, let it sit, you know, when you get those bad skating, you know, reduce those rejections, like, just leave it alone, you know. Because again, another problem I had that very first time was that, you know, I sat and just let it build, and I was seething in it, and, you know, I was just angry and annoyed. And then it was in that frame of mind that I wrote my responses, you know. And so I was not even in a good frame of mind to even take any, you know, constructive feedback at all. But I realize now that, you know, when I get disappointments or rejections, and I just leave it alone, because there's other stuff to work on, there's family stuff to deal with, like, there's so many other things, you know, vying for our attention. And so I'm like, okay, leave it alone, deal with other things. And then when I come back to it, usually if I give it like 2 weeks, sometimes or even a month, I can actually read and be like, okay, now I see this differently. Like, this was actually making a very, very valid point. You know, maybe they didn't have to say it so meanly, you know. And that's something I try to do when I review research papers. I try not to be mean. Like, I do my very, very best to, you know, kindly point out, you know, and also emphasize to the author that, hey, these comments are really to review, like, improve the quality of your paper. Like, I really think you have, like, something here, and if you make these changes, it will be clearer and even better, you know, for people. And so that's one thing that's really helped me, just leaving it alone and then coming back to it later, you know, because usually I'm in a different frame of mind. I'm more open to hearing that. But
yeah.
All right. So Kwame, one thing that we're doing as we were sort of researching your work as well as your background was noticing that you had a very special interest in increasing diversity and equity in STEM fields. Can you shed more light on your work and how you've been going about achieving this objective?
And so I've talked already about, you know, team and interdisciplinary efforts, and I think that's one thing that I've learned even in trying to increase the diversity and equity in STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Because again, I think, not I think, in the US, you know, when we talk about diversity, we're referring a lot to race, you know, and ethnicity, and all of those things. And so for me, you know, as an African, you know, scientist, you know, in the United States, you know, I do, you know, just try to seek out, you know, other students, you know, like myself, you know, with similar backgrounds who may be interested, you know, in doing science. And one thing I do is that I sort of pro bono, like, I don't have a company or anything, but, you know, just one-on-one connections, you know, I offer people advice, you know, if they're wanting to, you know, come study in the US, you know, ask them, like, you know, what do you want to do, what programs are they looking at, you know, I'll review your statement of purpose if you want me to, you know, things like that, you know. More recently, I get inundated with a lot of random requests, especially for people who are specifically wanting to apply to my program, and so it's more difficult for me to address those. But I remember even once there was a student who wanted to, you know, come to our university. I think, I don't even know if it was to do a PhD or something. And I was like, oh, we're only undergrad and master's. And then I think I just looked up some, because I think we didn't even do the program that he was interested in. And I just looked up some possible programs, like, hey, you can look into these programs. And the student was so, so grateful. They were like, thank you so much. Like, this is the best response I've received ever. Yeah. And mine was even they were very, very, like, sort of grateful, you know. And so I think that is one thing. Institutionally, I've been part of some efforts to improve mentoring practices of STEM faculty, you know, just to make them more inclusive of their mentees' culture and background and all of those things. A lot of sort of non-white people have not had the opportunity and access to scientific resources, you know, and so I think anything that I can do to help that, you know, if I sometimes intentionally seek students. And I remember one time there was a summer research opportunity, and I asked two students whom I figured in my mind nobody would ever want to work with them, but nobody has probably thought to ask them, hey, would you want to do research with them? Because they may not be the students with the highest averages or GPAs. Yeah. And so I approached them, and they were like, wait, like, you want to work with me? You know, and but then I think it was a very, very fulfilling experience for them, you know, I still hear from them, and they're both doing well and things like that. And so those are some of the efforts, you know, just being intentional about who to ask, who to involve, giving people who may not have opportunities, you know. I think a lot of times for students, just knowing that the professor notices them or is aware that they sort of exist as a human being beyond, you know, that sea of faces, you know, is usually very encouraging for them. So those are some of the efforts. There are some more institutional formalized efforts where we organize workshops for other faculty members, but then also just intentionally, you know, reaching out to students and, you know, just pro bono helping people who may be interested in similar career paths. Yeah.
That's very inspiring to hear. And it's encouraging to know that there are people that are also working to have everyone feel included, because I think in the academic field it's very easy to be in school and not feel like you're a part of a community. And so that's one of the things that I think it's very important, especially in the STEM field. And so, Kwame, to finish up, what advice would you leave for our listeners who are young and aspiring scientists in Africa, looking at all your total experience so far?
That's a big one. I was really reflecting on this one. I think advice is, something to reference something you said earlier, that don't be too worried if you seem confused, if everything doesn't seem clear. Be open to opportunities, be open to go different directions, you know. I think for me, just again, listening to the advice of my parents, you know, in moments that I didn't want to, and sometimes making compromises was sort of opening the door to what, you know, I was really going to enjoy. I didn't know it at the time, but sometimes, you know, making those compromises. A lot of times we have these dreams of, this is the school I must go to, this is the course I must study, these are the things I must do. And if that doesn't happen, if you get a different course, get a different school, be open to those possibilities. Life will not always play out the way that we want it to. But I think when we are open to different experiences and open to, you know, those different trajectories, you know, sometimes we end up where, you know, we really, really enjoy without realizing that was it. So that openness, that flexibility, and I think also just that humility, something that, you know, a viewer told me that, you know, I think I did take to heart, but I think a lot of times you don't hear the word humble and science, you know, sometimes go together. Having a humble science, not saying that you don't talk about your work, because as a scientist, you know, you have to talk about your work, you have to explain your work to other people. But then I'm realizing that you don't have all the answers. And one student of mine put this, you know, very beautifully, and you know, I always like to reference her. She said, we may be right, but only right now. You know,
yeah.
Like, we may be right, but only right now. You know,
yeah.
That all we are sure is that we have the answer right at this moment, but it doesn't mean it's going to be right, you know, 10, you know, 20, however many years to come. And so, just that, I think that's what I mean by humble science, you know, because a lot of times scientists can get very, very, they can really dig in, you know, to their work and what they've done and what they believe and all of those things. And just realizing that, yes, you're also influenced, you know, by your own upbringing. So I'm glad you also asked that question, because a lot of times scientists are like, well, the scientific method is objective and standard and we have no bias. But, you know, our life experiences and our upbringing and even our training, you know, predisposes us to think certain ways and see certain things, you know,
right,
as well. And so I think just having that the humble approach to science, that, okay, I may be influenced by something, I should listen to this, even though it sounds different, you know, that actually take it in, hold it up to the light, examine it, you know, you know, and see if, you know, I need to change, you know, what I currently believe, you know, what I currently, my current practice, you know, for this thing that might actually be better. I think that openness to always grow, always learn, and sort of take a risk. I'm maybe wrongly so the kind of person who hear an opportunity, don't have all the details and jump in, you know, and then figure it out, you know. And usually when I do that, it kind of works out, just because a bit of it is like, okay, I have to make it work out, you know, like I already said yes to this, so I've got to make it work. But, and that might not be for everyone, but I think that openness, and just recognition that I don't have all the answers and probably never will, has helped me. So I think those are two good things. Yeah, just don't be so sold on your dreams and how you need things to play out, because there's something in a place that you never even thought to look.
Awesome. So be open, be a humble scientist, and just be open to opportunities. So once again, want to thank you, Kwame, for joining us. We've enjoyed talking with you, learning more about your life and more especially about climate change and pollution on marginalized groups. It's been an amazing experience just listening to you. And so to our listeners out there, I hope you enjoyed this time with Kwame. And once again, you can find us on Facebook as Sunny, on Instagram at Sunny Podcast, and on YouTube as Sunny Podcast. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. And send us your comments, anything that you would want to hear about more. And just let us know what you find about today's episode. See you at our next session.
Bye.
Bye.